Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, how's it going? And welcome to episode 36 of Someone Who Isn't Me. I'm Daniel P. Carter, and my guest on this episode is Ina Selvik of the band Wardruna. Now, as this is the last episode of 2020, I did feel that it would be worth taking a brief moment to reflect on what a truly strange and shit year it's been. But I wrote a long monologue, essentially, of what I wanted to say. But as I'm sat here now looking at it, I feel that it doesn't really need to be said. Most people, I'm sure, feel exactly the same way. The effects of the pandemic have been absolutely overwhelming on every facet of society. I feel that the atomization and division that has been caused as partisan groups have played everyone off against each other for favor or kind of more unspeakable ends is just horrifying. And it doesn't need really reiterating in a long-winded kind of monologue, which some people might take the wrong way. So I'll give that a miss. This episode, however, with Einar is fantastic, I think. I really enjoyed it. He's created a world that harks back to a largely forgotten past and retrieves ideas and art that looks forward with an optimism and a newfound purpose. And as we discussed at the very start, this is a music that I feel sings to the soul and unlocks a lot of feelings to do with ancient memory and archetypes, etc. I believe that all art and music is a magical thing, but there is something about Wardruna and a handful of other bands that I love that gets straight to the heart of it. I'd never spoken to him before, even though I've been playing his music on the BBC for many years, so to finally have the opportunity to sit and discuss the music and the songs on the new Wardruna album, Kvitraven, which comes out 22nd of January, and we also to speak about the animist concepts that are central to the art that he makes. It was a total pleasure. I should, before we begin, give credit and thanks to Gordon White of the podcast and blog Rune Soup for the invaluable episode that he did with Dr. John Reed, where they discussed animism within Maori and wider New Zealand culture. That's definitely worth something that you should check out. And it was a real help as a kind of a refresher before doing this episode with Ina. So now that that's covered, I hope you enjoy it. This is Someone Who Isn't Me with Ina Selvik of Wardruna. Enjoy. I'm glad we're getting to do this, actually, because, you know, I've been an admirer of your work for such a long time, and I've played it a lot on my show. And yeah, it's been a long time coming to actually have a conversation about it. And I tend to get excited and things shoot off at different angles, which I know can be quite annoying for people. So I apologize in advance.
Digressions can be very fruitful and interesting.
I hope so. Yeah, not so much potential for me, but yeah, exactly. I wanted to say that what I wanted to start with essentially is that this album is the first work that you've done with the band since the completion of the trilogy or triptych of Gapvergenunga. I apologize now as well, because all my pronunciation is going to be so horrible. Please don't take offense.
No. Okay, you're doing good so far.
So since the completion of Gapvergenunga and Yggdrasil and Ragnarok, that was such a mammoth task, I think, and it was so vast the scope that all covered. How did it feel, firstly, to complete that trilogy?
Yeah, as you say, it was such a all-consuming process, both artistically and personally, I would say. It's there isn't a separation between myself and the art in many ways. So of course, when it once, I think everyone can recognize the fact that when once you're in this really intense bubble, then coming out of that process or that bubble can be very dual. So I would say there was a sense of relief, of course, and I was very proud of having gone through with it. It was lots of challenges along the way, and but at the same time, it's sort of a sorrowful process coming out of that bubble, where suddenly there are too many options out there, basically, which is not often a good thing. Well, often not a good thing, I mean. The completion felt both fantastic, but at the same time,
daunting, I imagine.
An element of mourning.
Yeah. When you're working on something like that is so, as you say, all-encompassing and it's so vast, you have a real sense of purpose, I think, and there's a real the compass for the direct and the direction of the creative drive is very clear. Even though in all those, in any creative process, there are constantly challenges and things shift because it's such a fluid thing, isn't it? But at the same time, there was a very clear drive and a purpose to the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I imagine that the how daunting it must have been to work on Kvitraven, it must have been. How did that process go about when you decided that this was going to be the next thing you did as a full band, and how did you find the direction for it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Well, as you say, the runes and that whole plan, it was, the runes are very specific. They are of course very challenging in terms of, well, they are also very cryptic. So being specific at the same time, some of these runes are very, it's very limited what we actually know about its deeper meaning, etc. So, but in any case, I would say it gave a really clear direction all of those 15 years, basically.
Yeah.
Even at the start of that project, I knew what I was going to do for the end part. You know, the song order, everything was ready from the get-go. So it was a very clear path in the sense of the end goal, at least. So I spent a lot of time figuring out where to start. What is it I want to say? Because, well, there are so many things I wanted to say, and tons of ideas that have come along during that trilogy process that I've just put in a drawer somewhere. For later. So it was a process of course revisiting a lot of those older ideas, some that was even from the very start.
I noticed that it said that the record has been in, you know, in that creative period from 2009 to now. Is that right?
Even much before that, even since like the first recordings in 2002, 2003.
Oh, okay.
So some of these ideas are really, really go really long way back, and so yeah, revisiting some of that, and of course, everything you do, whether or not it's within the art or as a human, you learn and you grow and you sort of encompass that into your toolbox in a way. So I'm not the same person as I was back then. So that's of course really interesting to revisit ideas like that with fresh eyes and a new set of well, at least many new tools in the toolbox. So I guess narrowing down that focus was it took a lot of time. All our music is sort of wandering in the same animistic landscape. It's very, very much about nature, our relation to it, etc. But this, I guess, from the very start, when I sort of started to think what the next piece would be about, one of the first things that became clear was that I wanted it to go more in depth in terms of exploring the human sphere in terms of these old traditions do some deep dives into what defines man in light of these old tradition, how it is quite it doesn't you don't have like the modern way of defining a human is if you're a religious person, it's body and mind and soul. For some, it's body and mind or consciousness. But the older ways of defining a human being is much more much more layered and more I would say complicated. So for the new album, that's one of the things that I wanted to do was to dive more into exploring at least some of these aspects of us as a being, and of course our relationship to nature. That's also very central. Animism and that kind of idea set of ideas is quite central.
Yeah. That's, I think, that one of the things, the way that this record and all the records prior to it have resonated with me so much was it was actually really defined in one of the lyrics to that's in Gra, where it says your song stirs something deep within like chords pulling straight from my memory. It's that's the thing that when I first heard your music and when I listen to this record now, that's the thing that draws me to it so much. Aside from the artistry of it and how beautiful it is, there is something very resonant within it that does, it moves you. I mean, music will do that anyway, and people can break that down in whatever way they want to, but I feel that creativity is a very magical thing, and I think
absolutely
and I feel that your music is something very rare amongst a lot of other music that I listen to, and that's not to belittle anything else that I love or other artists that I really that I'm inspired by personally, but there is something about it that it's very core that is very resonant. And I as when I was going through the lyrics, that lyric really summed it up for me, I think.
You're putting into words what it's my impression that a lot of people connect to our music in on a very personal level, but also in ways that it's hard to explain in a way, because it triggers something that seems very much in the core of our being, like it's in our DNA or something. And I guess, you know, if you go all nature-based tradition, all nature-based culture is born out of its environment. So even though the rapping can be different depending on where it arises, the core mechanisms are the same wherever you are on this planet. And so And this goes in terms of the musicology and musicality. Also, when you go far enough back in time, you see it's the same kind of rhythmical patterns, the tonalities,
the droning
in these, the continuity of sound, etc. Those things are really global, I would say, when you go far enough back in time, and very often when it comes to ritual music or religious music in a sense, but also within traditional music, and so here you have something that is so ancient and at the same time global. So it isn't very strange in many ways why it strikes a chord with people all over the planet in no matter where you come from or how old or young you are. It has that potential, and that's because it's in our DNA. It's so incredibly ancient, these things, that it triggers some sort of memory in us.
I wholeheartedly agree. I find that creativity or rather inspiration can be very elusive at the best of times. And I feel that there's like a real meditative quality to making art and music in particular, especially that requires preparation. And
it has such a all art has that ability to carry meaning and purpose and intention. But I would say that music, above any other art form, has I think it's in a league of its own, song and music. It's so potent. So using these, this musica mundane idea, the original world music concept, where what lies behind the music is just as important as the music itself. You know, it's more important than how good technique you have on the guitar or how fast you can blast, you know. It's more about the intent, what lies behind the music. It is more primary, more of a primary element than actually technique. I like that way of thinking, and it works. That's the point. It works.
Yeah, very much so. And that's because the music in itself was an expression of that essence, you know. It came about, I feel that all creativity, but music in particular, is an expression of that. People can view it in whatever way they want to, in more mystical terms or in scientific terms, but I tend to view it in a more mystical way myself personally, but that's just me. But I think that it is an expression of something beyond our physicality, and is moved by this essence that is within all things, which I think is why that you saying about animism is such an important part of the music. You can feel that, because I started thinking about it all because I find that, as I was saying, creativity can be quite elusive at times, but then you also have those moments where you can and I'm sure you agree, where you find yourself in a very abundant kind of flow state, where you kind of tune out of your the moment that you're in as somebody trying to be creative, and you almost step aside and you let that thing move.
Yeah, you become part of it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it moves through you.
Yeah.
And I think that that was something that I found really interesting, because there are times where I would be writing music, and at the end of the whole process, I would kind of sit there, or painting, and sit there and go, "Huh, interesting."
Yeah.
As if I've played very little part in it at times.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Sometimes it just flows from somewhere, and that can, sometimes it comes effortlessly. And I guess when I'm in these creative modes. I go very much into it. It's like I turn my skin inside out in a way. It very much consumes my being in when I'm awake and when I'm sleeping. And so sometimes I can wake up in the middle of the night and just have to go write stuff down and just go to bed again. And then when I wake up in the morning, there it is. There's been quite a few things like that. So it's once I go into that mode, it becomes very much everything I do in a way. It's hard to relate to anything else.
Yeah, because as you say in Visavading, is that pronounced correctly?
Visavading. Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, that's the most apparent, obvious expression of that of hunting for songs that are waiting to be found almost, and to be
exactly
to be coaxed out and brought forward and also in the title track as well where you say let me ask, teach me the song that allures you. That allures me to find you. I guess that's the approximate translation, correct?
Yeah. In essence, yeah.
Okay.
Everything is so open-ended with me. So
yeah. Okay.
So, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that, and as you say, that there's this almost primal point before. Where we find ourselves now, where most things have grown out of, because that started making me think about the Acaro songs that shamans in the vegetal community in South America, these kind of medicine songs that they sing for ceremonial purpose, and they say that these songs are taught to them by the plant spirits.
Yeah, it's the exact same. The song Visavading is basically about the Nordic version of that. This is, like you see this a lot in folk medicine. It's best preserved in the Karelian Finnish tradition, in their rune songs. So all of these healing songs, if you want to cure a snake bite, you need to know the song for the snake, etc. If you know the oldest word or the oldest song for iron, you know how to make iron. This idea that everything has a song or a sound or a frequency that you can tap into, and by learning the song, you learn how that thing works, and I don't know. For me, it's very much a set of idea and a concept that I use in my own creative process. Have been doing for the whole time, but it also has many layers to it. You can interpret it in many different ways, I would say. In the same way that I feel very strongly that, by going into the songs the way I do, the whole creative concept, it's very much... about letting the theme itself be the composer and me just being the instrument in many ways, and also in terms of all the research I do. So every song feels like some form of initiation. I learn a lot from one thing is the study part, but then once you express yourself through a song, you become that song in a way. So you and then after that, you basically possess that knowledge in a totally different way than you do when if you just read it the same way a song changes its form once you start performing it, because that's a different format in a way. Then you take it there, it's supposed to communicate directly with people and you become part of it in a different way.
Yeah, because the people watching then also become a part of that. And
exactly.
And it becomes this Ouroboros.
Circle.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's always very interesting to see how a song works when you take it to the stage. It's not always so easy to see which ones work and not, actually.
Yeah.
So that's always interesting.
Yeah, because then they have to take on a life of their own, and some of them will fly, and then, you know, like a litter of animals. Some make it and some don't.
Yeah. And some you have to change a little bit in order to make it work, because it's a different format, so it might have different needs.
Yeah, because initially when I first got sent, before I got sent the record, when I first saw that the title of the record was Kvitdraven, I thought it was going to be a more of a biographical record, in the sense that obviously that was the name you used within Gorgoroth, so I thought it was going to be more of that. But then, and I mean, any art is an expression of the artist, so to a certain degree that's true, right? But also, as we've discussed, these songs make themselves apparent, but also then there's things like in Munin where you're singing it from the perspective of Odin, and it's, or it seems that way from the translation as I have it. So therefore, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
No. The title is definitely not named after me, at the same time, it's of course part of me, and it's named after the same ideas that inspired me to take the name in the first place, in a way.
Yeah.
My relation to ravens are I have a very profound fascination for them. Have had that since I was very young, and almost like a totemic relationship in that manner, and of course everything they symbolize, everything they mean within the Nordic corpus, as well as being these messengers, being the bridge or the link between man and nature, or man and the deities or the beyond. So combining that with these prophetic white animals that you have in so many different cultures around the planet, and not only ravens, and very often their message or their prophecy is connected to bringing something new, or some form of renewal or enlightenment, or so for me, that combination of the raven and the white raven is such a strong symbol that has many layers to it, and a great deal of hope in it as well.
Yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah, it's interesting in Munin as well, where it seems to reference like quite a recurring theme throughout all of your work, and that is again, apologies for the. I'm just going by the rough translation that I have, where in the lyrics where it says, astray is the mind, without memory a tree will rot, and without its roots. And that made me think of, you know, that's a recurring theme, obviously, with Rotlaus Trefell, and how, you know, something that isn't aware of its past and its history is not going to weather well in the future.
No. It gives you direction. It gives you experience through your faults, through your scars, etc., and also through your glory, in a sense. Everything you carry with you is part of what shapes you and gives you direction. And so, the mind is astray without the memory. It is the pillar of all culture, I would say. That is memory collectively decided in a way that becomes the cultural or what defines your culture.
Yeah.
So it is, and for this song I didn't want to just recite Odin's poem where he says he's scared of Hugin or the mind not returning, but he fears even more that his memory or Moonin won't return. And but it doesn't say anything more than that. So I wanted to dive into why is that? Why is memory such an important thing? And why is he more afraid of that memory won't return? And yeah, I guess that's the backbone and kind of a good example of what it is we're doing overall, because it's not difficult to recite all beautiful poetry, but integrating it into the here and now and talking about what it actually means, what it can tell us, that's more tricky. You can also apply that to the musicology of it as well, you know?
Yeah.
Copying historical music is one thing, but making new creations that resonate today within the modern demands and all of these things that is needed in order to speak to a contemporary audience, that's a completely different thing, and that's what we're about.
Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And I think because of as that again points to animism being the basis of all your work, do you think that because I was thinking about this, do you feel that like losing in the animist worldview has been really, well, I think it has, but really damaging to our present? Do you agree?
Most certainly. I think we would regardless if for me, it's not even it doesn't have to be a spiritual thing or a religious thing. Just the idea that that nature is something we are a part and regarding nature as something sacred.
Yeah.
That's an attitude, you know. It doesn't have to be a spiritual thing at all.
Is it for you though?
For me, it's a spiritual thing.
Yeah.
It's a spiritual thing. It's a intellectual thing. It's everything, I would say, because there is so much logic to it as well. Just look at the world.
Yeah.
What's happening? And what started to happen the second these ideas were more and more disregarded, and that happened a long time ago. So it's not like I'm painting a pretty picture of the past and we just have to do what they did, because this happened a long time ago. But
yeah, I agree, because
in any case we should do better. We know better, and by applying this very simple idea, I think that would benefit us all.
Yeah,
bottom line.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that a lot of people would mistake animism for primitivism, and it isn't that. It can be very modern, but it's but anti-modernity is I think the way. We should explain briefly that animism is the idea that all things have a part to play and a spiritual essence to them, or an essence to them. It doesn't have to necessarily look at it, as you say, in a spiritual sense. And that we are just a part of that. Because I think that as soon as people assumed that it was almost like a food chain, and that we're the top of the food chain, and therefore everything else around us is a resource. I was going to say a source, but as a resource, and that's not true. We're a part of that ecology as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And it, yeah.
From a hermetic perspective of as above, so below, that works in both ways. You know, we are our own, you know, the human biome is its own little ecology, but it's also part of a wider ecology. And if you forget that, you start to mistreat things and abuse things. And the knock-on effect of that is it affects everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, with our knowledge, we should, by the logics, we should be the protectors of it, not the abusers.
Stewards at best.
Because we know better. It's that simple. But hopefully, I think more and more people are realizing these things now. And I really like when you see so much modern science basically just affirming animism. And I love that so much. I love that so much because I don't think there is any contradictions between them, really. It's just, it's so fulfilling to see whenever that happens.
Yeah, because it has come back around, because it does feel like, you know, I've discussed with people before on this, the idea that science and, I don't know, maybe the esoteric were interlinked. You know, it was astronomy and astrology. They were twins. You know, it was physics and it was alchemy. And then as things separated, it became one, science became more dominant. But now you're right. It does feel like now especially within the quantum field and new things that are coming out and being discovered, or new theories being proposed, that it does relate back. It is
the example of trees. You know, how this network how they communicate basically with each other, how they feel pain or react to pain in one. Yeah, you can call it that.
And support each other as well, and using mycology and fungal layers to communicate and also to feed each other, and this beautiful symbiosis where there's this trade-off of energy for the good of everyone within a forest, for example. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
But you have to also remember that part of why it's like that, why we have this idea that that we're talking about primitive things is also about how it's been portrayed for the last 1,000-2,000 years for religious or political motivation, basically.
Yeah.
That's why there is so much misconception about what. Yeah, what sorcery is? What is that? Or what was it? Because it definitely wasn't the how most people think it was. And I guess that applies to many of these old ideas that we have a very stereotype. View of it that is not necessarily correct.
Yeah, animism is the default modality of all kind of religious and spiritual, like the kernel of it all. You know, I think I was thinking about this. It was only later that things became sort of anthropomorphized, and you know, the sun became like it had different aspects. So it would be Shamash or Sol, or you know, it was only then that it was anthropomorphized and then ended up with, I guess, Christ, if you want to look at that as an example. But that thing as a means of sustaining life and giving warmth and helping crops to grow, and that's the center of it. That's the important part, you know, not the having to say, well, this is Ra, or this is which, however, you know, Helios, or
I guess it becomes problematic when religion becomes a means of controlling people. When things started to change and monotheism and it's some people say that it's monotheism isn't ethnocentric or religiocentric, but it is in its very nature. It is actually both ethnocentric and religiocentric. This idea that one's own belief is superior to others, etc., and this whole salvation thing that everyone else has to believe what you think, etc. It's all these mechanisms in order to control people, basically.
Yeah. And it's funny as well, because I think most people, I was listening to something recently and they gave the example that animism is the default for most people without them even realizing it. You know, I think the guy that came up with the term animism was a scientist called Tyler, you know, hundreds of years ago. And he viewed the example that was given in this thing I was listening to was saying that he viewed animals, pets rather, as nothing. They contain no soul. They have no personality. They're just a collection of atoms that kind of exist in a household if people have pets. But anyone that has a pet knows that if you have a dog or a cat or whatever pet it is, it has its own personality. It has, you interact with it, you speak with it, it's a part of your family.
And it affects you, you know. When a dog comes into a room, it has an effect on you. And vice versa, of course.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking that, you know, we were saying about how that idea being lost has really affected the world we live in. But I think that New Zealand, for example, is a great example where those ideas and are very much part of modern culture, in the sense that within the Maori community, you know, that there's a river that's, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's the Wanagui River, has just been given officially personhood and all the rights that entails, and therefore also a nearby forest is going through the same thing, in the sense that in New Zealand law they're considered by the Maori to be an ancestor. That river is an ancestor of our people as much as our biological ancestors, because if it wasn't for them we wouldn't be here. They sustained us, they gave us drinking water, they let us fit, you know, we were able to fish for food, and it irrigated our crops. So therefore,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing, right? And it's therefore that has now been attributed personhood in law, and it's now widely accepted within New Zealand that if you need to plan, for example, if they want to build a highway through somewhere, well, that can't happen because this is a person. You can't do that to a person. So do you know what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
But that's exactly what we're talking about. They're treating it with respect as something they are a part of, and that is a part of them. The Maoris, I love how they, even when they go into a forest or they cross a river, they always say a karakia, like they ask for permission or sort of state their business in a way, and I like that idea. It shows respect, basically. Which is basically what this is about, for me, I hate preaching, but if there is a message, that is it, you know. It's about that respect, that viewing it as something you are a part of, something you should protect, something that's, it's we only loan it, it's our children's in a way.
Yeah. And I think the music is the sum of that, in the sense that I was thinking like when I was preparing to do this with you, I was thinking about, I was very lucky to see you play some songs in the Norwegian embassy in London a while back. And that was a real pleasure to be invited in the first place, because I found it astounding that the government of Norway has embraced the fact that this music is a huge part of Norwegian culture. And I don't mean just specifically your music, but I, obviously, Christian's art was on display. Gahl's art was on display. So when you think that, you know, when the black metal scene in back in the day was, you know, it was in all the tabloid papers and it was in the magazines and it was the most extreme, da 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 da, all this stuff. And for a government to turn around and go, well, we're very proud of the actual artistic export of what this music is and the effect it's had on a worldwide basis. And I found that astounding for a start, that they'd embraced that and recognized that. And it was something that I found so alien that it would never happen here, unfortunately. but so I thought that was incredible. But so to see when, sorry, I've said I'd go off on funny tangents, but another thing I noticed, actually, weirdly enough, while we're talking about that, one thing I took away from that, aside from being amazed by, to just have you tell the stories of the instruments, which is what I want to get to in a minute, which is where this is a long ramble to get to that. But the other thing was it was incredible to be in that building and to be shown around. And I got shown the some of the artwork in there that was truly incredible. And I was surprised that it just was kind of sat up on the wall in this place rather than a gallery, I suppose. But the thing I took away as well is, as I was leaving, that the tree out the front of the embassy is like a giant algas. I don't know if that was me just reading too much into it, but it was just this giant tree that it looked like it almost been. I don't know if it maybe it had been shaped that way, but it was pretty astounding.
Yeah, we ordered it specifically like that.
Yeah, if you could have it do that. But anyway, that was a long ramble. To get to the point that I wanted to say was, when you were talking about the instrumentation, I found it fascinating because it seemed that I may have remembered this wrongly, but you were saying that, you know, these instruments, even though we have descendants of them, I guess we could say, there's no real original instruments remaining. So you're going by a literary source and drawings and carvings about what these instruments are. And then you have to work out how to play them and how to tune them and what they are. And that, again, relates back to them showing themselves. But these are our limitations. This is what we can do. Is that... Do you see what I'm trying to say?
But it's kind of a giant jigsaw. Because, as you say, some of these instruments... don't give us much. So you have to do a lot of detectives work. One of course is found in the instrument's own limitations. Some instruments are quite locked and in terms of what you can and cannot do on it. But also that gives you a sense of tonality, music, the musical specter within. Yeah, some cases a quite narrow field, basically. There are also instruments that we have that there is actually a living tradition of using them, some dating back to Bronze Age even, you know, like 3,000 to 5,000 years that we know for sure. And we also know that at least from like 400 or 500s, some of these instruments didn't actually, the tonality, how they were tuned, didn't actually change that much. Now I'm talking about the goat horn or cow horns, but that horns with playing holes, basically. And this is basically they are living tradition, and tonality is basically confirmed by archaeological findings that have instruments that have been found in quite good shape and been examined to figure out their pitch, etc. And it didn't really change. So that also gives you clues that you can actually, in the older traditional music, you see the same kind of tonality. So that gives you some good ideas on the sort of tonal palette you should work within. And then, of course, you have the poetry, which was so central. And they are, that's, of course, a very complicated thing or tradition, craft, where there is so many different poetic meters or structures with their own set of rules of how it's supposed to be created. And we also know from like the earlier song tradition, both in Norway and Iceland, that there are song recipes of how you can sing a poem that is written in a specific meter. So that also gives us quite a bit of clue. So it is a lot of detective work. And then also, I don't know, I was very determined on when it comes to some of these instruments that I didn't want to hear any music ever played on them before I got to try it out myself, because I really wanted to approach it like a child. Like try and find the instrument's own voice before like applying all of these other presumptions or things to it. So it's, I don't know, it's an ongoing process, but it's really interesting because I realized once I was going through all of these things that the broader my overview of these small jigsaw bits of that big puzzle, more and more things also became clear in terms of the framework and the logics behind some of these things, and that's only like one part of it. That's the sort of the scientific thing. But then you can apply the logics of performance, for instance, which is an own totally different set of logics, and they are, I would say, many of them are quite timeless in terms of how they work. You know, you do and cultivate what works when in front of an audience. That's you know, if you're a comedian and tell a bad joke, you don't do the same joke or do it the same way the day after. You change it, you perfect it, and so so applying these performative logics to it as well, which is something I've learned also by doing, by experimenting, by performing in sometimes, and quite often I also perform in settings that you could almost call time right in terms of the origin of the instruments, trying them out in a full longhouse over a crackling fire, etc. See how that kind of poetry works. See how the instrument actually work in that kind of setting. That also gives a lot of clues and knowledge to sort of continue to build on. So yeah. It's but it's a very fascinating process that I'm in a way feel like I'm in the beginning of, because I'm constantly seeing new building bricks for that. So it's a very continuous process, organic process.
Yeah, and I think the proof is as we said at the very start, the way it resonates with people all around the world is when you know that you're on the right path. Do you feel not a pressure, but what am I trying to say? Like, you're essentially now the ambassador for this, form of music. But I was saying it's a wider thing. Obviously, as we've fully concluded at this point, you know, and I think through the TV work that you've been doing and through the Assassin's Creed game as well. Now you're the not only the guy that people go, well, this is what we need. This is what we need to complement what we are trying to achieve. You are the person to go to, but also it elevates those things, I think. But do you feel is there pressure on you to be that person, that ambassador almost, because you're carrying the torch literally? Is it a burden, or do you feel a big responsibility with it?
No. I don't, that's not my perspective.
Yeah.
And if other people experience it like that, I'm just doing what I would have.
Yeah.
And what I've been doing all along. And in terms of the art also, it's not something I'm thinking. I don't create music for my audience. I create music for myself.
Of course.
And then if other people like it, that's of course a fantastic bonus. But my focus is never on that part of the process.
Yeah.
I'm creating.
I didn't mean so much from that perspective. I meant more in the sense of
In the wider sense, you mean?
Yeah, in the sense that, you know, you are doing this incredible work of like an archaeologist to a certain degree, you know, and rediscovering these forms and bringing them forward.
I don't feel the pressure because I do it for myself in a way, and you create but when you're true to yourself and you're true to something you're really passionate about in a way, you the potential of creating these ripples in the water is of course much greater, and I guess that's what I'm doing with this. It's ripples in the water, by being true to myself, true to the ideas that I set out to do. I guess that's when these things occur, but I don't think I feel any pressure. That's not something I think about. And
good.
I know some people see me as this character. That's not my perspective in a way. The fact that, of course, it's something I notice because. You get recognized and etc. It's not, you know, if you're at a festival, it's not very private anymore.
Yeah.
To put it like that. But so of course I noticed in those kind of ways. But even that is just great thing, because people are very nice, people are very respectful, and it's fantastic to see that the work we are doing and the music we are creating have such a it has an effect on people, that the fact that people are connecting to it on a deeper level. The fact that some of these songs are totally living out like their purpose in a way, like the song Helvägen, which people has for many people become a very important part of life and of death, which is what the song is about. So
it's funny you say that, because that was what I was going to finish with. It was when my mother passed, I remember I'd heard the song obviously prior to that, but I think I watched, I saw a performance that you did with Aurora actually. It was profound, the effect it had, and very comforting. That's all I wanted to say. But it's funny that you would say that.
Yeah, it's a special song, and it's of course moving to see. The song is born out of a need in a way, and I guess the things that are born out of a true need, something honest, something. It was not trying to mimic like doing a death song. It's just basically me reflecting on a tradition that we're not or a part such an important part of life that we don't really deal with anymore in that sense. It's not part of our lives anymore, and that's of course a big a very special feeling to see that song living in its own life, and also the fact that I get a lot of it's special to see when you get a lot of when I meet fans or get mails or messages, etc., from people who has been helped by the music. That's of course a truly, it's a gift, basically.
Awesome. I think that's a great place to finish. Thank you.
Pleasure was mine. It was a good chat.
Thank you for listening to episode 36 of Someone Who Isn't Me. Thank you to Ina for taking the time to speak to me, and also thanks to Julie, Lauren and Morgan for helping to make this episode happen. As I said in the intro, thanks also go to Gordon White of Rune Soup and Dr. John Reed for the refresher course on animism. You can find Ina on the socials at Ina_Selvik or at Wardruna. Their new album, Kvit Raven, comes out on January 22nd. It is fantastic. Thanks for all the responses on Instagram as well, because I asked who you'd basically like to hear as guests on the pod in 2021. And as I was posting your replies and tagging a few of those people in, I got messages back from Maynard, Jonathan Davis, Raoul Reynolds, Chelsea Wolfe, Amelie from Merca, Frank Carter, Craig Reynolds, Wade McNeil, etc., etc. All of them agreeing to come on the pod. So hopefully there'll be some good ones in 2021. I think I just need to be a bit more proactive with this thing, eh? You can find me at Daniel P. Carter on the socials. Please follow the podcast at Swim Podcast and leave a nice review on iTunes and stuff, because that affects the charts and I obviously crave validation, don't I? Anyways, I'm out. Peace.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.